So welcome to lecture two, freshly refreshed from lunch. All right, so what we talked about last time with tree amplitudes and the way of trying to write down the answer without worrying too much about the details of the Feynman rules. And in the example that I gave, we wrote down a six-point amplitude in a theory that would have include some kind of d phi to the 4 interaction with some coupling g4, and potentially also local terms that would be of this form, plus potentially other things. OK, so what we did was we said, OK, well, let's figure out the pole terms. And we figure them out by factorizing and working off what we know about these Unschill amplitudes. But we are aware that we may make a little bit of an error in this because we may have ambiguities from constructing these pole terms that feed into the local terms. So that was sort of the outcome of what we did in the last lecture. And so I can also deal with my local terms. And what I mentioned last time was that there were basically two different kinds of local terms at that order that corresponds to two independent contractions of the Lorentz indices. And they're independent in the following way, that if I think of them as Lagrangian terms, anything that involves box on phi is zero, because that's the leading order equation of motion. And that translates at the amplitude level into saying that the momentum squared of each particle has to be zero because they're massless. And that's just directly box translating, box on phi being zero translating into to p squared being zero for each external state. And then we also have integration by part. And that allows you to move the derivatives around between different terms. And at the level of the Unschill amplitudes, the type of term that you have left over in integration by part would be a total derivative, which we can throw away because we don't have any boundary terms in these cases. We're all in flat space. So these total derivatives, if you think about how they act on some fields, then they would basically sum up all the momenta. And so integration by parts at the level of the Lagrangian translates into momentum conservation for an n particle amplitude like that. So the rules that you have for understanding what are the independent local operators in the Lagrangian translates into rules that you have for manipulating the terms you have in the amplitude, namely that the amplitude external states have to be on shell. That's using the equation of motion. And integration by parts is using momentum conservation. OK. So in particular, let me just illustrate. I said last time that if I had a term of this order, for example, that this term here wouldn't contribute. And I argued that was because the only thing it could be would be s plus t plus u. And that by, oh, sorry, this would have to translate into the equivalent of s plus t plus u, namely the sum over all the Mandelstams, and that this is zero by momentum conservation. How can I see this from the point of view of a Lagrangian term? So if I look at this as a Lagrangian term, I have a choice of where I put my derivatives on these six fields. I could put all my derivatives on one field. So I would have something like d phi to the fifth, and then both derivatives on the same field. But now we see that that, by using the leading order equation of motion, would give me zero. So that's not the way to do it. On the other hand, I could also distribute that on two different fields. So that must be what I have to do. So I write this as d four phi, phi to the 4, d phi mu, d mu phi, d mu phi, contracted this way. But let me now rewrite this as 1/5 times the derivative of phi to the 5th times d phi, d on phi, like this. That's just regular manipulation. And then I can rewrite this as 1/5 as a total derivative of this form here, except that then I have to compensate by subtracting off a term where the derivative acts on the other part, and I get that. And this rewriting then immediately tells me that this gives me zero by equations of motion, and this is a total derivative And again, these two rules, the integration by part that this corresponds to and total derivative, that is just the, what I say when I rewrite this, any way of trying to rewrite a linear polynomial in the S variables that is fully symmetric in all the indices will vanish. And there's no other way, I just don't have any other options of getting something non-zero. And I can see that from the Lagrangian, because no matter how I put my derivatives on my fields, it's either going to vanish by the equation of motion or because it's a total derivative. Okay, so that just connects the rules a little bit of how you construct the local terms. All right, so far so good? Okay, so these two rules are useful to have in mind, that when you manipulate the local terms you can have, you use momentum conservation and on-shellness, and when we use the equivalent terms in terms of Lagrangians is using leading order equation motion and integration by parts. All right, now then when we did this calculation, we constructed the pole terms correctly, and I said that there was an ambiguity that I can absorb into my local terms, and that gave me two constants in our example. This is so general that it has to capture any kind of theory of this form, including those with special symmetries. And a class of theory that has special symmetries of this form, as was asked right after the lecture, would be something like a theory, for example, that would have a shift symmetry. So what if I wanted phi to have a shift symmetry plus a constant? Or even what a DBI theory has, a further shift symmetry that would shift the field by something that is linear in the space-time coordinates. This type of symmetry would manifest itself as a soft theorem. Or what is known as an Atlas zero, if you're more familiar with pion physics. In saying how fast the amplitude has to go to zero when any momentum of the particle is taken to zero. And that kind of constraint can fix the constants. But that is, of course, only one kind of theory that would fix the relative coefficients between these two terms in the Lagrangian. But in general, our construction has to take all possible options into account. And that is what the method does, and that's why it has freedom in constants. That in order to fix these constants that come from the on-shell way of constructing the amplitude, I need something else that restricts me down to one theory that would have certain relationships of these coefficients. And one such example of this would be a soft theorem. So this was just to basically recap on what we did at the end. If you were worried about why can I only construct the amplitude up to some constants in the local terms, that's why, because it has to be so general. All we used was just Lorentz invariance and locality and factorization on the poles. It has to capture all such theories. And it's only really when you impose additional symmetry that you can narrow down these constants or even give you hope of doing so. All right, so any questions about that part? Question always welcome. All right, so that's our tricks for tree level, that it's poles and it's local terms, and that's the whole story, up to imposing symmetries. Now, what about loop amplitudes? If you think about it, tree amplitudes, they are basically what are known as rational functions in the Mandelstam, for scalar amplitudes and just in the Mandelstam variables, which means that they're basically ratios of polynomial terms in the Mandelstam. There's nothing else they can be. We've seen they can only have local simple poles and so on. But for loop amplitudes, the structure of a loop amplitude is that you have to integrate over the momentum running in the loop. And so, on the other hand, the thing that you integrate over is constructed out of the Feynman rules, and that is a rational function. So a loop amplitude is integrals, if you have more than one loop, over rational functions of the kinematic variables. And you know from your calculus class that those things can give you interesting functions. And by interesting functions, I mean functions that have different analytic structure than the trees. They're not just rational. So that can result in things like logarithms or dilogarithms or more generally polylogarithms. And technical language, worse logarithms, and worse non-logarithms. And they have prettier and more technical properties of names. Okay, so that comes out. And you're familiar why? If I took a simple integral like dz over, say, 1 minus c, then that would give rise to minus log of 1 minus c. So that's a nice rational function. And when you integrate over it, you get a logarithm. And sort of similar things, and of course, worse can appear. Now, the new thing that appears here is that such things are not just things that can appear that can have poles, but the new thing that appears is that there can be branch cuts. And in particular, for a logarithm like this one, if I think about taking myself into the complex plane, z, then this function is pretty nice in most places, except when I get to 1 and above, then there's a branch cut. And as you go up, then you get this ambiguity in the value. And so here is the example of my branch cut in this case. And so when we deal with loop amplitudes, or things that can have loops, we have to take such things into account. Now, that sounds maybe scary, but it's also extremely useful because it can help you fix the amplitude. The way that these branch cuts appear, one thing that is useful to understand about them is where they can begin to appear. And the way that they appear is at the threshold of the thing that runs in the loop being physical. So let me try to explain what I mean by that. So branch cuts in amplitudes appear starting at the threshold of physical particle production. And I'll illustrate what I mean. Okay. So, example, let's take our case. For example, like this. This could be scalar QED, where I have some photons, and they have some four-point interaction with some massive scalar that runs in the loop. And I'll, just to have something to write here, I'll call these part of the loop momentus L3 and L4. But that's, of course, these are, of course, related to each other. We'll call this momentum P1, P2, and this will be P3. And P4. Okay. So we have learned this rule in quantum field theory classes that when you have a loop, you're supposed to integrate over the loop momentum that can run here. And so you don't worry about this particle that runs inside being on shell or not. It's generally some virtual particle that runs in the loop. However, one can construct the loop amplitude, or at least part of it, the cut constructible part, by making a cut where you put this internal momentum on shell. So that gives you one piece of information, not the full integral, but one piece of the information. And if I look at it in some center mass frame for the external particles 1 and 2, then S is P1 plus P2 squared. Then the momentum conservation that holds at this vertex will tell me that that has to be the same as L3 and L4 added together. So L3 plus L4 squared by momentum conservation. And normally that leaves an ambiguity of something I can integrate over. But if I wanted to see what would it take for the massive particle to run in this loop to be created at the minimum energy of S, what does it take to create two massive particles here? Then I would say, okay, let me pick L3. To be the mass of the particle. I would create it at rest. And the same for L4. I will create this particle at rest. So this is mu components. So if I pick them to be at rest, then what this gives me is that I can create the loop particle at rest when I have enough energy to do it, namely at S equal to m plus m squared. So that is at 4m squared. And if I have more energy than that, then I can create this particle as a physical particle in here with just some momentum in it too. And so this is the threshold for creating that particle as a real physical particle. Yes?
Yeah, just a technical question here.
Yeah.
So we know in the CM frame, so L3 and L4 have opposite momentum, but how do we know that they're both zero?
Ah, so I'm just asking that I could take the external particles to be in the CM frame. So that means that this is the minimum energy. So this becomes the center of mass energy.
Right.
In the CM frame. And so that is the minimum energy I need for this incoming pair in order to create these two internal particles right on shell. Yeah. That's the idea. Yeah. Yeah. So CM frame asks about the external momenta. The L part is about how much energy would I have to have in order to create these actually on shell. If I have less energy, I still have a loop amplitude, and I still have to integrate over the loop momenta and do everything that I'm used to in Feynman rules. We don't even specify normally what the external momenta are. They're just variables that hang around. But if I ask the question, what is the minimum energy I need to create these particles on shell, then that would correspond to a center mass energy squared, which is 4m squared, so by kinematics. And so in that case, what will happen is that analytically, in what I would now call the complex S plane, then that will be the threshold for where this amplitude will have its discontinuity or this branch cut. So that's where it would begin. And that's why you would see things like logarithm, not of 1 minus C, but something like 4m squared minus S and things like that show up. Yeah.
And which point is the direction of the branch cut chosen? So the branch point has to be at 4m squared. So
ah.
Take the cut anywhere, I guess.
In principle, but I wouldn't expect to see things that would look like log, say, is or m squared, 4m squared, minus is that would go up in the imaginary axis. They lie for the real physical momentum. They have to lie here. If s were not real, then I wouldn't hit the threshold. My external momentum is supposed to be real, and that's why the branch cut ends up lying along the real axis. Very good. Yeah, but that's a good question. And in fact, it's sort of a little bit axiomatic, what you know about the general structure out here. But usually, and what is often, and what we will be working with, is what is to some extent just physical reasoning of what we know about loop amplitudes, but also a little bit axiomatic, what you can assume based on mathematical properties, is that any kind of interesting pole structure or branch cut structure lies on the real axis. And as long as you're away from the real axis, you sort of expect nothing to occur. Yes?
How are we really using this information of the branch cut?
So we will be using that a little bit later in the lectures. So that's why I want to mention it. It has to do with what the general structure. We talked about that there are simple poles. But now we know that when there are loops, there can also be branch cuts. And that is the general structure we expect for amplitudes. When you go and you look in the complex plane of Mandelstam variable S, there can be branch cuts and there can be simple poles. Simple poles correspond to exchanges of physical particles inside of tree diagrams. So they must also lie on the real axis. And off the real axis, we don't expect anything to happen. That's the idea. OK, more questions.
This don't expect part, I mean, is that
yes.
Reasonable assumption? I
mean, it's reasonable assumption. There's a nice paper that lays out sort of what exactly is known, which I think is called something along the lines of a toolbox for S-matrix bootstrap by Amit Sever and Sasha Sivoyedov. And that's worthwhile looking at because that sort of states more precisely what this means. If I just use my Feynman diagram reasoning, I would say, okay, you know, at least I know at the tree level part, I can only have my simple poles along this axis. There's no way an amplitude should have simple poles at some weird complex value of S because that doesn't mean anything physically. And the same reasoning for branch cuts would give you that. But that's not a proof to say that all amplitudes must be like that, that you have to use much more machinery to get to. But that is basically what we will be using. And that is the idea that a general amplitude in some theory will have some properties, and this is part of what makes it a nice physical amplitude, that if I look in the complex C plane, then it can have simple poles, like we talked about. And it would have those in certain places. Wherever they are, who knows what this spectrum is at high energy? So that could be some M1 squared, some M2 squared, some M3 squared, etc. And then in addition, there can be branch cuts. We need another color for those. They can be blue. And that starts at some threshold for whatever can run in the loop. It could be one of those masses. It could be something else. But that then lies a long way here. And of course, there can be one more thing, which is that there could also be poles at zero. And in principle, there can also be stuff out here. If I think about what is called the forward limit, where T is zero, then U is minus S. And there could also be poles in the U channel. So there can also be stuff out here. And it has the same structure as this. It starts at some branch cut. And then there are also discrete masses that could lie there. But we won't actually have to worry about that for the application that I tell you. But anything off the real axis of S, you won't need to worry about. OK, so that's a little bit of an abstract view of what an amplitude has for analytic structure. And the deal is basically that the interesting stuff happens at the real axis, and nothing interesting happens off the axis.
Should yeah. we take seriously the poles which are under the branch cut? Or?
Yeah. So yes, you should take those serious also. So all the red poles, they correspond to diagrams where you have your massless particle on the outside. And then your massive particles is exchanged in this way. And then the branch cuts is the type of loop calculation that we just looked at. This is the particular branch cut for the threshold to two particle production. There are also threshold for free particle production and so on, that would be relevant for doing higher loops. But the general structure is that there is some point where the branch cut structure starts. And then there are also discrete poles that we need to think about. And if you feel unhappy about these guys lying here, we can do a little bit epsilon deformation in them and move them off the axis, and we can do contour integrations on them. And that's basically what we'll end up doing implicitly. OK, so this one was the mass MA, and then we have the external states there. OK, so that's the structure. Sometimes we talk about theories having mass gaps. And what we would think about here is that I have my external particle, let's say my particle phi. If that is massless, I can have massless poles from that. But if I assume that everything else has a mass that is strictly greater than zero, and that anything that could run in the loop is strictly a mass greater than zero, then I would say the theory has a mass gap, which I could take to be the lowest mass of which either the pole or a branch cut can occur. Okay, so that would be the mass gap in the theory. So the lowest value at which anything occurs, or everything that I don't know about, I'll put above that. All the unknown UV physics, I'll put above. And then there was a question in the first lecture, where the question was, what about the massless particles running in the loop? If you had massless particles running in the loop, that threshold goes all the way down here. But we'll be working under an assumption that we have weak coupling. To the extent that weak coupling in these particles, phi, interacting with themselves, that is so weak that we can neglect their own loops running, that's subleading to the structure, and therefore we can neglect it. OK, so we won't worry about that. And that means that anything that can run in loops is the sort of unknown UV physics. So all the red and blue stuff here, one way you can think about it is that is the UV physics, that high energy physics that you integrate out in order to generate a low energy effective theory. And what we want to understand is that if this is the structure of the amplitude, that this low energy physics really comes from probably integrating out some massive stuff, whether we know it or not, then that will impose some bounds on the low energy physics, namely the Wilson coefficients in the EFT. And how that works is what we will now be starting to go through. Okay, so again, the way to think about it is this stuff here is UV physics. And going below M gap is where we have our EFT physics. In principle, we could have some other UV scale that wasn't M gap, but this is just a natural way to pick it. Okay, so yes, go.
What happens if we go, for example, from the S channel to the D channel?
Very good. So it's very, for the theories that we have talked about so far, which have this full Bose symmetry, nothing is really different. It's just a reparametrization of the problem. It will be very logical for us often to think about the S channel because we know that encodes energy squared and then a center momentum frame. And so I will not necessarily be setting T to zero. That is one particular limit where you can extract some bounds, but you can get much stronger bounds without doing that, and we'll do that.
And what are all diagrams with radiative corrections?
So that's exactly the question. Diagrams are radiative corrections in the massless field we are neglecting because they're higher order in the leading order coupling. So whatever the equivalent coupling of what we called in our Euler-Heisenberg model was square root alpha prime, so Thein structure constant. That coupling we assume to be small and throughout the problem, so that anything that is higher order correction in that can be neglected. So that would create things that behave logarithmically in the low energy expansion because that encodes the running of the EFT coupling, and we'll neglect that in this question. It's a very interesting question, how this physics behaves and how these bounds behave when you include them, but it's not something I will talk about here. And it's only a bit, well, it hasn't been explored that much actually, but it's a very interesting question and relevant. Okay, yes?
Could the M gap be above the 4M squared?
This M gap, you mean it could be before this one?
Above.
So I take M gap to be the smallest mass where I get anything that happens in the analytic structure. So the smallest, either what is the small, you can pick it to be either the smallest mass of a pole or 4m squared, where this branch cut appears. So it's just something that separates the scales of the UV physics and the low energy physics from this point of view. But it could be very, very small, or it could be very, very large. It doesn't actually play a role except of setting the scale of the Wilson coefficients. And we want to eventually impose bounds on the dimensionless part of the Wilson coefficient, not the massive thing. So this will basically scale out of the problem. All right, okay. So let's think about now this bootstrap idea. The first thing we'll think about is the general behavior of amplitudes in this regime at low energy. And so that is basically what we learned from the first lecture, that at low energy, and all of this is for 2-to-2 scattering, or what we call 4-point amplitudes. And the reason is that no one knows to do it for anything else than 4-point. And if you find out how to do it for 6-point, that would be, let me know. That would be very good. Okay, so we do it at low energy first, and this is all going to be 4-point scattering. So what do we know about low energy? So just like we talked about, at low energy we can have diagrams that make maybe look like this. Let's say that our external field is some scalar. I can have diagrams. This perhaps there's a cubic interaction that makes this guy interact with itself. Phi I'll take to be massless. Okay, so this gives a massless pole. Then I can have diagrams with maybe other particles exchanged, say some vector exchange, depending on what I have. Perhaps this could occur, plus other things. And these are, of course, what we call the pole terms. And then in addition to that, then we have the E of t terms, which could be some b0, pi to the 4. There is, in general, a term proportional to s. There's in general, and I will work in terms of s and u with the understanding that s plus t plus u is 0. So everything that we write will be a function of s and u. Then I'll have another term, which is the u. And one thing you notice here is that before, we required that this amplitude was fully symmetric in s, t, and u. I'll not assume that anymore, because there could be additional structure, or I allow different types of particles. There could be a non-abelian structure. So I'll just write the most general thing that this can be. So this is no longer necessarily abelian. It could be something that has more general structure. So let's write down the most general thing. Yes?
The phi to the 4 should just be
constant? Oh, phi to the 4. I meant constant. So this is phi to the 4. These are terms that would arise from this type of form. Sorry, I mixed up the notation. Then there are terms that I will call b to 0 that are s squared, b to 1, which is s times u, b to 2, which is u squared. All of these would be different contractions of d to the 4, phi to the 4. And again, I'm neglecting the point that these guys could be both symmetric, but writing down the most general expression plus, of course, dot, dot, dot. And all this stuff here, all this, that represents that the massive stuff massive particles that lie above the mass gap being integrated out. And integrated out basically is similar to what we saw in the first lecture. I look at the limit where my energy in the problem, my s and my t and my u, are much smaller than the mass of this particle, and I expand the actual amplitude at low energy. That would be what I know if I knew what the high energy physics was. But here, I'm just parameterizing and say, I don't know what the high energy physics is, but whatever it is, when I let these masses of this unknown stuff be very high compared to what I'm looking at, it will be encoded in some coefficients in a polynomial form of this. So all these coefficients, b0, b10, everything like that inside those orange brackets, that represents the unknown UV physics. Does that make sense in terms of what we did before in the first lecture? Please ask if something is not clear. Or when something is not clear. Yes, good.
Yes, I'm sorry if you already said this, but why doesn't T appear?
So T, I can always remove and rewrite in terms of S and U.
Okay.
So T is minus S minus U. So my general amplitude, I will only think of as a function of S and U. Very good. Other questions?
Is there a specific choice for S and U or greater than S and T?
No. And also what I call U, some other people call T, and what I call T and other people U. So you will see, and you have to figure out what they're really talking about. But everybody at least agree on that S is from the 1, 2. And then I have T being 1, 3 and the other one being 1, 4. I will have a reason for picking S and U when we get to the actual problem that we're going to bootstrap. But for now, there's no particular reason. I could just pick T as well. Okay. But picking and leaving out T eliminates the momentum conservation redundancy right away. So every one term here corresponds to some local operator in the effective action. Okay, so far so good. I don't need to know what these operators are unless I want to explain it to somebody who only wants to think about Lagrangians. Yes?
Sorry, I have a question about that.
Yeah.
You integrate out all the UV physics. How do you do that?
Okay, so in general, in one example we saw earlier today, I had pole terms like this, and all I did was expand in small momentum variables over the mass squared. And then I got this geometric series, and I could read off what the coefficients were and relate them to particular choices of these coefficients over here. So that is one way, which is very simple, to integrate out. The other way we saw it was from a loop amplitude, that I compute the loop, and then I expand it again in small s over m squared and all the kinematic variables over m squared. And I will get at the leading order something which is the Euler-Heisenberg Lagrangian. And similarly here, in general, if you have some very complicated theory, it can be hard to integrate out. For some thimble theories, it's basically a Gaussian integral, but in general, you may not be able to do it explicitly, or you may only be able to do it as a low energy expansion to some order. But here we'll just say whatever you did to get there, it will result in some low energy expansion of this form. And whatever it was that was integrated out, whatever the spectrum was, it will give rise to some coefficients. So we saw from Euler-Heisenberg how the coefficient depended on what particle I integrated out. I could even have various combinations of those particles integrated out. And that will all change the particular values of the coefficients that sit here. And what we're doing is we're saying, well, we don't know what that UV physics is. We're being agnostic about it. We just parameterize it in terms of those unknown constants. And the goal will be to find out what are the possible parameter ranges of these constants for the theory to come from something that has this kind of structure with a couple of extra assumptions. And a priori, again, if this was just low energy expansions, these could be anything I wanted, positive, negative. What we saw in the examples that had sensible UV physics was that a lot of these parameters turned out to have to be positive. And we'll in fact see that all of these ones in the example that I'll show you have to be positive. Okay, so that's the goal. So these are not now no longer coefficients that we necessarily know what are or how to calculate them or what kind of UV theories can produce them. We just say any kind of theory where something is that happens at that are massive at large scales, we go to much lower energy scales and we get something that is polynomial in the momentum. Yes?
So since all the poles are about the m gap, then the pole terms are no UV physics?
So the pole terms that we have here just correspond to whatever is in the low, that is massless in the low energy physics. And it won't really play a role for us in the story of constraining these other high dimensional coefficients, or this, the ones that may have negative mass dimensions, as we'll see. But that was just to illustrate that there can be stuff that has poles at the origin, but it won't play a role for us. Yes. Sumir?
Is it enough to consider just the first few terms in perturbation theory to determine the analytic structure, or is there cases where a non-perturbative resummation?
So good. So there are two perturbative arguments. So there's the perturbative argument and what results in these coefficients, or what results in the branch cuts. And there we're in some sense at any order, because the details won't play a role. But then there's the question of these guys, these massless ones that could run in the loop and basically renormalize the UFT couplings, and those effects we'll ignore. We'll just assume that the coupling is small. You can ask very good questions about what happens when you include them or whether you can resum their effect and so on, and that has to a large degree not been touched in the literature. Yeah.
So why don't we get any logs in this expansion?
If you had included loops in the massless particles, there would have been logs correcting these coefficients.
Yeah.
But they would depend on whatever these couplings are at higher powers.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're assuming that we can neglect them. And that's, of course, an assumption that says there is some weak coupling limit. An example that has this is string theory, where I can work at leading order in the perturbation theory in string theory, which means that I'm working at genus zero. OK, very good. Great questions. Okay, so the actual problem that I'll apply this to is in a particular theory, and I have a good reason to do it in this theory, because it illustrates the ideas in a technically slightly simpler context, and it includes something interesting. So we're going to apply, we don't have to apply it in orange, I guess, we can apply it in normal white. As the collective we will apply this in, and this means this whole bootstrap that I haven't explained yet, we'll apply this in the context of theorists' favorite theory, which is n equals 4 super Yang Mills at large n. Large n, n being the rank of the gauge group. Okay, so I will say a few words about what n equals 4 super Yang Mills is, but let me first explain why we're doing this. So there are two main reasons. One is that there is a technical simplification that arises from only considering the terms that can arise in this low energy expansion that are compatible with supersymmetry, and this is maximal supersymmetry. So that gives a technical simplification. Simplification of the analysis, which makes it nicely suitable for lectures and for working on as your first project on the S-matrix bootstrap. And the other one is that it includes a very interesting case, namely the open superstring. Amplitude, which is known as the Vinciano amplitude. And so I know that whatever I do to bootstrap the equivalent of these B coefficients in that context, one point that has to lie in that space that's allowed is the values that the open superstring has. And so it also gives me a goal of saying perhaps in the future, with some low energy type of sensible assumptions, we can even narrow ourselves in on bootstrapping the open string. And I'll also give some examples of that tomorrow, what you actually can do. Okay, I will not solve that problem of narrowing in on the open superstring, but I'll show you some things that we know. Okay, so what is the, that makes sense. Okay, so what is n equals 4 super Yang Mills? So it consists of, includes Yang Mills theory, which is the gluons from the standard model. And then it has gluinos. These guys, the gluons are massless spin 1. Gluinos are massless spin 1/2. And then there are 6 scalars that are real scalars, that because they're scalars are spin 0. And I combine these 6 scalars into 3. Here, I'll pick it up so you can see. Into 3 complex scalars. And all we need to know about these is that I can pick one of those pairs, and I'll call that complex scalar, one of these 3 complex scalars, C. And then there's a conjugate one that I'll call C bar. And that's going to be the scalar sector of the scattering of these complex scalars that we're going to talk about. Okay, so, and there are 4 of these gluinos, by the way, which is why it's n equals 4. Yeah?
Yeah, what's that 6 scalar, is it?
So I have these six scalars, so this is the entire spectrum.
Oh, really?
And then the 6 real scalars I can combine into 3 complex scalars.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And one of those complex scalars I'll call C, and its complex conjugate I'll call C bar. And those are going to be the heroes in the story.
Right. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Actually, gluons are also heroes in the story, but we don't need to look at them too much. So let's talk about what Yang-Mills theory looks like and its possible higher derivative corrections. Okay, so the context here will be n equals 4 super Yang Mills, which is a two-derivative theory, renormalizable, It's not even need to be normalizable because it's actually conformal. But now I'm going to add to it higher derivative terms. So that is these operators that we can add. And first I want to think about these guys, of course, from a low energy point of view can be any values. But I want to understand what constraints we can put on them in terms of these positivity bounds that we've been discussing a little bit. Okay, so what can I have? So the Lagrangian we can have for this will have a leading order term, which is trace F squared. That is pure Yang-Mills sitting right there, just like it appears in the standard model. And now I need to think about what my higher derivative terms can possibly look like. And we talked a little bit about this with Euler-Heisenberg. And with Euler-Heisenberg, I said that if I try to write down an F cubed, it's going to be zero, or it's basically a total derivative. And in this case here, when it's non-abelian, then I can write down trace F cubed, and it's not zero. However, it's not allowed by any amount of supersymmetry. So we can cross that one out. This one exists, but it is not compatible with supersymmetry. So the next possible thing I could write down would be trace F to the 4. I have to build things out of Fs. It's the only gauge invariant thing I can write down and Lorentz invariant thing I can write down. Okay. And then the next thing I can write down is I can start dressing it up with derivatives. And then dot, dot, dot. I only care things with has four Fs because I want to think about the four particle scattering amplitudes. Anything with more Fs belongs to 5 point and higher. So I don't want to worry about it. But I can dress this up with two derivatives, then four derivatives, then et cetera, et cetera. And I have to worry about all the different ways of contracting the indices to get this. Now, under supersymmetry, all these external states of the spectrum, all these particles that sit in the spectrum can be in external states. And the amplitudes with four gluons are necessarily related by supersymmetry to amplitudes with four scalars. And these are complex scalars, so they have to appear in complex conjugate pairs. So this particular operator maps over to something that has four derivatives, one for each of the Fs. And then it has two Zs and two Z bars, where this is just one example of one of the complex scalar pairs that sit in the story, the complex conjugates. Does that make sense? Okay, so it's four derivatives because each F has a derivative acting on the vector potential. That's those four derivatives. And it turns out that the only way you can combine the scalars is this way, two Zs and two Z bars to get a real interaction. Okay, so that is one version I have. And this, of course, needs to have a trace too. Similarly, this guy under supersymmetry maps to trace of something that now has the four derivatives from the Fs plus two more. And so this will be something with six derivatives on Z, two Zs, and two C bars. And I haven't told you how to contract those indices or how to put them on the Fs, but they have to be there in some way. Okay, we're still good? We're good? Questions? Yes?
Yeah, math, in a sense, we also have them in the Lagrangian, right?
Yes, exactly. So these are the Lagrangian terms.
Yeah.
That the amplitudes are related to each other under Susie-Ward entities. When the amplitude, the whole Lagrangian consists of all these different pieces. It's not just that, but it contains all of that stuff that's included in, or whatever. So it's included like this, I guess. Subsets of. Okay. And then similarly for all the other ones, these Lagrangian terms must be included with some Lagrangian terms like this. And whatever is the coupling of this term must map to some coupling of this term also. Now, what does this map to in terms of the amplitude? So we want to look at amplitudes with two Cs and two Z bars. And it turns out that the leading interaction that you can have with two Cs and two Z bars is one that, let me do it right, actually looks like this. Oops. So here is one, and I'm going to make these square brackets around to indicate that this thing is what is called color ordered. I'll explain in a second what I mean by that. But it means that the ordering of the states matter. So the Feynman diagrams I write down have to follow this ordering. So this is state 1, 2, 3, and 4. And they can interact with each other through exchange of a gluon. And the interaction gives rise to a term that is S over U. Okay? And this is pure Young-Mills, this term here. Or pure N equals 4 super Young-Mills from this interaction. And nothing to do with the hyperderivative terms, only coming from this leading order term in the Lagrangian and its supersymmetrization. Okay? And then from this operator, we see that the next term must be order p to the 4. And from this term, we see that the next terms must be order p to the 6. And so on. And eraser. Okay, so what was this color ordering thing? The color ordering says that I remove a trace from the amplitude. So this part, this amplitude, should really be part of something that has a trace structure in all the non-abelian generators. Like this. That's what you get if you just calculate it with Feynman rules. You would have something where you can have a kinematic part, and then you can have a trace structure. And of course, in general, there would be many different ways of ordering these guys. And each of them has a gauge invariant coefficient, and we pick off one coefficient that corresponds to this color ordering. The equivalent statement is that the Feynman rules must have all these states ordered. And when I said that we're looking at large N, that means that all that matters for our amplitudes are the single trace contributions. Okay, if you're how many are familiar with non-abelian gauge theory? Okay, some people, not all. All you need to know is that the ordering of the states here matters, and that's one reason why I cannot have a pole that involves these two particles, but only these two or these two. I can't have anything that jumps the order. Okay. Okay, so what do I end up with? Let's look at the different terms that could appear here. So the order p to the fourth came from some four-derivative interaction. We know that four derivatives has to be expressed in terms of Mandelstam variables squared. And so they must be of the form that we had over here, namely of this form here to begin with. And we see that these two terms of this order were not allowed by supersymmetry. Okay, so order p to the 4, the most general thing I could have would be b0 s squared plus b01 su plus b02 2 u squared. And it turns out that supersymmetry, and I won't prove this because that takes a little more machinery, but supersymmetry takes the chalk. Supersymmetry does not allow you to have this one or this one. This get excluded by supersymmetry. That is one of the technical simplifications that we'll have. At order p to the 6, what could we have? We can have b30 s cubed plus b31 s squared u plus b32 s u squared plus b33 u cubed. And then it turns out that supersymmetry does not allow, n equals 4 supersymmetry does not allow the last two. In fact, in general, the only ones that are allowed by supersymmetry must have at least one factor of S squared. Those are the only ones that turn out to be allowed. And so SUSY requires is squared factor at all orders in the low energy expansion. And so that means that I can now write my amplitude, which I'll denote like this, an amplitude as a function of S and U, which is our Z, C, C bar amplitude. I can now write this as my leading order term, which is just standard pole term, plus pulling out that S squared. I will write a sum over K and Q here of A, K, Q, S to the K minus Q, U to the Q. Okay. All right, let's take a moment and just sort of figure out what was going on. So we started n equals 4 superheating mills. There were certain terms that were not allowed in the vector sector, like F cubed. Then we saw that the lowest order term we could possibly have by contracting the indices in an F mu nu would be F to the 4, some contractions of that. That gave rise to terms in the scalar sector with four derivatives acting on a pair of complex conjugate scalars, C and C bar. Then we can have more derivatives of that, and that's basically corresponding to those higher derivative operators with F squared, F to the 4 dressed with derivatives in different contractions. Then we impose on these operators supersymmetry, and it turns out that at order P to the 4, there's only one term allowed. That is the statement that of trace F to the 4, there's only one possible operator that's compatible with n equals 4 supersymmetry. And you could think about different contractions. We saw that for Euler-Heisenberg, the abelian case, there were two independent terms. So in those two independent terms would not be allowed by supersymmetry. It would be the non-abelian particular linear combination of those that would be allowed. Yes?
Are we assuming S-channel somewhere?
No, right now there's no S-channel or anything assumed. We're not even thinking about this picture here. All we're worrying about is what could the low energy expansion of such an amplitude with n equals 4 supersymmetry look like.
So why is it then not symmetric to U?
Why is it not symmetric in S and U? It's partly because by picking this color ordering, I'm separating out the S-channel. This is 1, 2. That's a little bit special compared to, say, T, which is not allowed because it's in a different place in the color ordering, and U, which also involves two different types of particles. For that reason, it's not symmetric in S and U. Because there's these two, the U channel, it involves Z and Z bar, but the S channel only Z and C. So it doesn't have an SU symmetry. However, when we write this story like this, that is not the only constraint that we find from supersymmetry. There's also another constraint that for this order here, supersymmetry doesn't just exclude those two terms. It also says that these two coefficients must be the same. And that type of pattern actually extends down here and says that supersymmetry requires that the terms in this sum, once we have taken the S squared out, actually must be symmetric in S and U. And that requires that the coefficients A, K, Q must be the same as A, K, K minus Q. And that's another constraint of n equals 4 supersymmetry. And now I've used all my n equals 4 supersymmetry for the 4-point amplitude. Okay, so I could just have told you from the beginning, n equals 4 superheating mills supersymmetry requires that the amplitude looks like this. But I wanted to try to argue first why the lowest order interaction appears at order momentum to the fourth. That has to do with the lowest operator in the vector sector being F to the 4. And then after that, you dress with derivatives, but that's not enough to ensure supersymmetry. There are certain constraints that arise in the most general form. And in particular, that pulls out this factor of S squared. This kind of constraint that appears here is something that we'll call crossing symmetry, because that's what similar constraints are called in other papers where it actually is crossing symmetry. But really, what it is here is just supersymmetry that this comes out. But we'll refer to it as crossing symmetry to sound like there are other cool people. Okay, so Let me try to put this ansatz a little bit in context. And please, please, please ask questions along the way. There's a lot of stuff that goes into this. Okay, yes, good. Yeah.
Why are we considering Z bar scattering, but not any of the other fields?
Because I want to get it to a point where I can deal only with scalars that gives me some simplification in the S-matrix bootstrap rather than doing it for vectors. And it just allows me to borrow some mechanical parts from other problems. It's a little easier because when I'm in the scalar sector, I have better control of what the operators and the low energy expansion is. And one thing that is actually very useful here is that this S squared factor buys me a lot, it turns out. I'll explain why. It allows me to put bounds on things that other people can't put bounds on because they have lower dimensional operators. Okay. Very good. So we have this low energy expansion. Let me try to reiterate what each of the parts are. So we have a coupling in this expansion here that is A00. These are both non-negative numbers, and Q, we don't want any negative powers appear here. So Q is bounded by K. So the lowest thing that can appear here was A00 that had the P to the fourth term that maps over to trace phi to the four. So this is the coefficient of the combinatorial factors of trace F to the four. Now, such a term appear in the alpha prime or low energy expansion of the Vinciano amplitude. So if I put Vinciano here, I will tell you what each of these coefficients are for that particular case. And Vinciano for that term has a coefficient, which is pi squared over 6 times alpha prime squared. So you can compute the open string disk amplitude, 4-point. If you do strings, this picture may seem familiar. That's a disk amplitude with 4 operator insertions. You can compute it. You get an exact answer for what it is in terms of gamma functions, and you expand it in low powers of momenta compared to alpha prime, or sorry, small alpha prime, and then you can get that as your leading coefficient in the amplitude. The leading order will be Young-Mills. This is the subleading order. Okay, then the next order amplitude we can, the next order contribution we have here is when k is 1. And when k is 1, q can be either 0, which you just get s, or it could be 1, in which you just get u. And by this crossing or supersymmetry constraint, this is the same as A11. So there's only one operator at this order. So this is the n equals 4 Susi version of trace d squared f to the 4, just like we had it up there. And if you go to string theory, the value of this thing here is the zeta function, zeta 3 times alpha prime cubed. Okay. Actually, pi squared over 6, which zeta function is that?
Zeta,
it's zeta 2.
Yeah.
This is actually zeta 2. So some of you who like number theory might recognize those numbers. Okay, then.
So
yes?
The question is, what are the non-trivial zeros of zeta?
Ah, well, here they're just, yes, that's a non-trivial question. I cannot answer that. But I know some conjectures about them. But that's not so important for us because here just the numbers appear. And, oopsies. And then we have A20, which must be the same as A22. And now you know the pattern that these are the n equals 4 Susi versions of trace d to the 4, f to the 4. And you say, aha, but there must be two of those because I have an independent coefficient, A20, that can also show up for these. So there must be two independent ways of sticking these derivatives on the f's that are not related to each other by integration by parts or equation of motion. They must appear. or Bianchi identities for that matter. And if you do the string, then you find that this is A20, A22 is equal to pi 4 over 90 times alpha prime to the fourth, and A21 is 1/4 of that, and so on and so forth. That's a zeta 4. Yes, very good. That's zeta 4. This guy is zeta 4, and this is 1/4 zeta 4. Yeah.
Is this appearance of the zeta function related to where that minus 112 business comes from?
The minus 112 is the sum of all the integers?
Yeah.
Not directly, I think.
I heard that come up somewhere in string theory.
It does come up, but for this part here, these zeta functions only arise as expansions of the gamma functions. I can write down the expression for you. But this is probably a simpler occurrence and nothing to do with any kind of regularization of sums. That's just an exact expression. We know we expand it in small alpha prime, and you get these values in Lorentz expansion. Okay, so that tells you that within this class of models, the open string lies there, and whatever bounds we get from sensible UV physics, that better be a point in these bounds. In particular, by the way, all these AKQ, which you could call the string values, are positive. You never get a negative number in this expansion, so that's kind of interesting. Maybe we should get something like that. Okay. All right, how are we doing? We're doing, I don't know, how are we doing? Are we doing well? Let's have some questions before we dive into the difficult parts. I shouldn't have said that. Yes?
Okay, it's not like incredibly naive, but you broke open string?
Yeah.
It looks like a closed string on the drawing?
Ah, which one? Ah, okay, because this is a disk. So this is a disk. And if I had to compute a closed string amplitude, I would have picked a sphere like that. And then I would have put, in case of a four-point amplitude, four vertex operators on that. So that gives you the closed string amplitude, and this gives you the open string where these are put in on the edge. Yeah, good question. The color ordering that I mentioned over here, that I put out a color trace, that ordering here precisely corresponds to the order at which I put these guys on the desk. 1, 2, 3, 4. And the amplitude knows which order they have because they're ordered on the disk. But because it's round, there's also cyclic symmetry, and this guy has that too because of the trace of the structures, color structures. Okay, more questions. All right, so this is my low energy expansion, but my whole amplitude in this regime, not just the string, but my whole amplitude should really be something that has an analytic structure like this. So how do I possibly connect that low energy expansion to something that should come from this? And that is where the most technical part of the argument comes in. So please just stop me at any time and ask questions that I can't answer, and perhaps some that I can too, so the recording doesn't look too bad. But maybe it will anyway. Okay, so we're now putting things together. We want to make a connection between this analytic structure, the assumption of this analytic structure, and this low energy expansion. So here is what we're going to do. We're going to use this picture. And now I'm going to look, because I'm first interested in the low energy regime, I'm going to look in some small region around S equal to 0. So some small region there. So I will then write the following thing down. Out of the blue, I'll pull this out of nothing, and hopefully we'll be able to see what we can do with it. So I take my amplitude in the S, complex S plane, and I'm going to divide it with an S prime here. It's going to be an integration variable. So that's why I call it S prime as opposed to just S. Okay, so I'm going to divide it by S to the power of k minus q plus 3. If I do that, then I notice over in this expansion that this will isolate a term which has a simple pole in S, which is exactly the one that has the coefficient with the value of k. But I haven't specified q quite yet, so let me also do that. And let's actually write down the whole expression that I want to look at. And then we'll go from here. OK, so I'll take this. I'll now differentiate this. Q times with respect to u, compensate with a q factorial. And then we're going to look at figuring out what this thing is. OK, so out of the blue, I write down this thing here. This, I notice, will involve terms with s to the k, u to s to the k minus q, times s squared times u to the q divided by another factor. Well, so let's write it down at s to the k minus q plus 3.
Isn't the q order derivative?
The what, sorry?
Isn't the q order derivative?
Q derivatives of respect to this. Yeah. So take this derivative q times. I should have said that maybe clearer like this. Yeah, so take the derivative q times. So if I just take this term, then if I look at a one particular term that has the coefficient akq, it will look like this. And that will mean that I have a simple pole in S times u to the q by the choice of the power of this factor of S in the denominator. Okay? So it looks like that times akq. And then I differentiate this expression, q times with respect to u. That strips off this u, but it generates a factor of q factorial, which this guy takes care of. So once I have done that, then I would be down to something that just had akq 1 over s. After taking, okay, let me do this. I take 1 over q factorial and q derivatives with respect to u. This strips me down to just one particular term in this expansion, which goes as 1 over s. And then the only thing I didn't deal with yet was this integral. And that integral I picked to have a contour, which encircles 0, and is exactly this contour here, which is chosen small enough that it's below the mass gap. So it will only pick up, the only analytic structure here is the pole at 0 of this integrand, which we now see is exactly akq. So this whole thing evaluates to akq. Questions? Yeah?
You said u to 0 after taking your...
Yeah, I said u to 0 afterwards to get rid of other terms. That is very good. Excellent. I also said u to 0 afterwards to avoid any higher powers in u to occur. Very good. And so in general here, I would have a term that would be all sorts of powers of k and q that would occur from the low energy expansion. But I eliminate those by taking the q derivatives. And then I single out the simple pole. And that selects this particular one coefficient. And I can do that for any k and q in the expansion. Yes?
The residue of the pole in the center is
equal to q? The residue of the pole?
Well,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When I do it for this function here, if I had done it without dividing by s to this particular power, I would have just picked out the simple pole that could have been there if I had had a pole at s equal to 0. But I'm very particularly choosing the integrand with this power of s in order to single out just one coefficient. So this is true for all k and q. And it just gives me a fancy way that doesn't perhaps look particularly useful of writing all the coefficients in my low energy expansion. OK. So at this stage, what we're going to do is turn on the power of the complex analysis class that you may or may not remember from your past. And hopefully you do. I think you do. So what we will do is to say, fine. So now we have all our low energy coefficients in terms of a contour integral. And we used the low energy expansion for that. But this function that sat up here, I didn't have to use the low energy expansion. This should be valid for the whole function, which has all this interesting analytic structure up here that I don't know anything about because that's my unknown UV physics. And as you can imagine, what we always do in this situation is that we'll deform the contour. So we'll deform this contour and make it bigger and bigger and bigger until you can rewrite it into one. And then I need my new colored chalk. What do I have? We will deform it into an orange contour that circles each of the simple poles. As well as, and you can think of moving those poles off a little bit, as well as my branch cut. And then I have to close it off at infinity in some way. So that is what this integral has to be equal to. And that is going to be the connection between what we have as the low energy expansion that is picked out here and what appears at high energy, which a priori I don't know about. Okay, so the new contour that we deform to has different contributions. So it's going to have something from the pole terms. It's going to have something that comes from the branch cut. And it's going to have something that comes from the big arcs, namely those things out there. We get rid of the stuff that comes from the big arcs by assuming that the amplitude falls off fast enough that there won't be any contributions out there. And that is the assumption that the amplitude as a function of S and U divided by S squared goes to zero as S goes to infinity. And that is known as the Frassard Marden bound. And that is not a very strong assumption in the presence of a mass gap. But it is nonetheless something that we put in. So that gets rid of all the contributions that could possibly occur from any arc out there. Then we have to deal with the stuff that came from the pole terms and from the branch cuts. So let's write down what that is. Okay. Let's see. So I'll give you a little bit of intermediate detail and then basically jump, I think, to the conclusion. So what we get now is that we have terms that come from the pole terms. So we have our 1 over q factorial. Then we have ddu, q derivatives of that. And now we have to pick up from that contour integral the stuff that came around each of those simple poles along on the axis. So we don't know where they are, but we'll write them as a sum over A that labels the location of the poles. So MA will be the location of the pole, MM squared. And then whatever you get must be the residue at S equal to MA squared of the amplitude A of S prime, comma U. And this must be divided, since we're evaluating it at that pole, at MA squared, to the power that we have in the denominator there, which is K minus Q plus 3. So that takes into account all the little orange circles here, summing over all those things. Then we have the part that comes from the branch cut. So here is a term that comes from both above and below that gives you a bit of a doubling, but let's write it as ds prime, s prime to the k minus q plus 3 from the denominator up here. And then whatever is called the discontinuity for the amplitude across that cut. And this integral, importantly, will start at whatever is the threshold for that branch cut, whatever that may be. We don't need to know what it is. It will just be something. And the assumption is that that something is greater than 0. So we can separate things. OK. Now, one thing we have learned is that residues on simple poles factorize. And since we have a four-particle amplitude here, the only thing it can factorize into are three-particle amplitudes. And three-particle amplitudes have to be very simple. They have to involve something that is on the s-pole here. So this has to be something with c, c, c bar, c bar, and whatever is the massive particle that runs in between. And because these two free-pipe vertices must be each other's complex conjugates, whatever coupling this comes with must be an absolute square of that coupling. OK, so that must be something that is positive. And so two facts is that the residue of the pole s of ma squared of the amplitude like this can be written as a sum over whatever is the spin L of what is exchanged. And in principle, we have to take all spins into account. Of whatever coupling that free particle amplitude has, absolute value squared. So this is GAL. This is GL prime, or star. And then we can write the rest of the dependence in terms of Legendre polynomials, which just says something about the angular dependence associated with the spin of that particle. And that looks like this. So this is a Legendre polynomial for the ELF wave. OK, you hoped you wouldn't have to see those after doing ENM. But these always come back to bite. OK, now what about that discontinuity? I'll tell you a few words about that, and then we'll be about done for today. And then we'll see how we use it next time. And I threw my eraser away again. So that discontinuity has the following form. I forgot something important, which is that when I deform the contour, I get a minus sign. Ah. Oh no, this one doesn't have a beam I can pull it down. Okay, you have to put in the imaginary minus sign yourself up in that expression. So that's a useful one to have. All right, then the disk contribution, disk A, is going to be minus 2 times the imaginary value of A. Here's basically optical theorem at play. And that has what is known as a partial wave expansion. And it looks like this. Minus 32 pi, sum over spins, again, of whatever could be running there. 2L plus 1, imaginary value of some coefficients, AL of S. And then again, your favorite Legendre polynomials multiplied in of 1 plus 2u over s prime. And this is also s prime because that's what we're integrating over. And the partial wave expansion is such that the imaginary value of a of ls has to be positive or non-negative by unitarity. All right, I'm sure you're tired. I'm tiring you out for the next lecture. OK, now These Legendres appear in both expressions, and in, where did they go? It went up there. In one of them, the S prime is replaced by the masquerade, but it's a similar part. And what you then have is that we can write these Legendre polynomials in a form that if I have 1 plus some delta, these are polynomial in delta. You can think of this part in your spherical harmonics from EMN as the cosines of theta. Okay, so these are polynomial terms in this delta, which goes from L. What did it say? So this goes, sums from Q equals 0 to L of V L Q times delta to the Q. And these VLQs that appear here have an explicit form, which, because we're in four dimensions, they're Legendres. I will simply just write what they are. And then it's something that you can work out, or you can ask Mathematica to do. They look like this. Divided by Q factorial squared. Okay, what is the main thing about these is that there are some positive numbers that you can write down. All right, now we're going to put all this together. And we'll combine these two different terms into a unified form. So imagine that you take both these Legendres there and the one over from the pole term there, and you put it all together. And when you do that, you can write the coefficient AKQ as follows. It's the sum over L, which appears in both of them. And then we'll write an integral over some parameter that I'll call M squared, which is an integration variable.
One question.
Yes.
Why consider the q equal to 0 if in the other side we're doing this multiplication?
This is just the summation variable for the Legendre, but it will show up in terms of the q that is here because I'm differentiating with respect to u, so that will pick it up.
The case for VL0.
VL0. VL0. So 0 factorial is 1.
The A goes from 1 to Q.
From 1 to Q. A goes from 0 to Q. Thank you. I understand now. Thank you. From 0 to Q. Thank you for that. Very good. Okay. All right. So I write this thing. I have some factor of the M that appears to the power of K plus 3 times VLQ. And this row, I mean, this looks nothing like what I had before. I've changed the integration variable from S prime to this M squared. And then this Q will be the sum over these couplings that appeared over there up on that board from the simple poles. And then I put in a delta function such that every M I get will hit the correct mass pole. I only get something for each one of those that I pick up. And then this must be multiplied by the VLQ that we had here. Sorry, the VLQ sat over there. So that came from the Legendre polynomial up there. I already accounted for this. And then there's a second term, which is 32 pi times 2L plus 1. And then the imaginary value of AL of m squared. Okay. And the reason we get this is that each of those two terms we had, the discontinuity and the pole term, had minuses. We had the forgotten imaginary minus sign up there that I can't reach because I changed the contour around. And all of that amounts to something where this is definitely something that cannot be negative. So I now have the expression of each of these coefficients in terms of something that is an integral over something that cannot be negative. And so the outcome of that is already from this stage that you can see that all these coefficients must be non-negative. And so with that, I will end for now, just so you can see where the positivity statements of these coefficients come in. But we'll be able to extract much, much more information about these coefficients and their relations to each other from this expression. And that will be what we'll do tomorrow. So a little bit technical interlude, but it gets better tomorrow in terms of less dispersive integrals. So thank you. Yes?
What's the reason for doing the continuum integral multiple times around each individual pole? Is that just easier?
I just have to pick up all of them. And so I don't really have to do them so much individually. It just expressed each pole is just the same form. It's just the sum over that A. And I just have to think about one of them, and then I know them all. I just have to sum over different masses, and they could have different spectra running inside.
Can we also include the poles inside the branch?
Yeah, yeah. So if you don't like them sitting inside the branch, think about moving them epsilon up, taking the contour, taking epsilon to zero, and going back down. Great. Yes?
So could you repeat where the minus sign is supposed to go?
Up on the very top, when I went from my original contour integral, what was around here, and I deformed it to the big orange one, mm-hmm. I should have picked up a minus sign that had to sit up there in front. And that minus sign will cancel the minus sign that I get in the residue that sits right there. And if somebody pulls down the board for me, some tall person, I can do that. And the other one came from this discontinuity up there, so those minus signs will all cancel and create a plus up here. That was where it was.
I did use the hockey stick.
Oh, yeah. The hockey stick. Good.
Had a good rep.
Okay, here we go.
Is there no one for the board behind that one?
The one that's just too tall for me, I think. So. Maybe there is one. Good, now I'll put in my red minus sign right there. Thank you. Good. Finally, I got to use this. Anybody else has questions? All right, I'm happy to answer something in the coffee break too.